I'm Afshin Rattansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from Dubai in the UAE. Major geopolitical shifts are underway in the Middle East as the US reduces its presence there after failures in Iraq and Afghanistan. And as Washington pivots towards the Indo-Pacific, China has begun filling that void with a slew of economic and diplomatic moves, mediating regional conflicts and strengthening ties with Arab partners who have shown more agency and autonomy in the wake of NATO's proxy war on Russia through Ukraine. Joining me to discuss the implications of China's rising influence in the Middle East is Ebrahim Hashem, Asia Global Fellow at the Asia Global University Institute at the University of Hong Kong and former strategy advisor to the chairman of the Abu Dhabi Executive Office. Thank you so much, Ebrahim, for coming on. Billions of dollars then in the past few days signed off at the Arab-China Business Conference. Well, what is this business conference and what's the significance of all these deals being signed as, well, Western Europe... Germany's in recession.
This business conference brings together the Arab businesses, the Arab entrepreneurs, the Arab state-owned enterprises with those from China, not only China mainland, but also from Hong Kong, to explore opportunities, to see how they can actually work together, especially now that both sides are really getting more familiar with each other, and both sides see opportunities in their relative respective markets. For example, the Arab world, especially the Gulf region, is the major region of oil and gas. It's a major supplier of crude oil to China. China gets around 40% of its oil imports from the region. And for the Arabs, China is a major crude oil market. And these deals are not really only related to energy, oil, and gas. They are really broad and really long-ranging. They include technology, innovation, infrastructure, and so on and so forth. As you know, the Arab countries, almost all of them, are part of BRI, the most ambitious initiative in human history. It's more than 10 times the Marshall Plan, the post-World War II Marshall Plan. And there are so many opportunities provided by this initiative. And also, this initiative has a vision to really bring the world closer together.
The Belt and Road Initiative, of course, that's not what you hear about in arguable NATO propaganda, NATO media propaganda. And aren't the Arab partners worried about, I don't know what happened to it, but Joe Biden's reported consequences for Mohammed bin Salman if Saudi Arabia didn't do what it was told to about oil production? No one's scared about what Biden might do?
Well, I'm not sure whether the regional leaders and the regional people really pay attention to what foreigners say about their bilateral relations with China or with any other nation. These are really sovereign decisions made by sovereign countries. So the Arab countries, they really look into the future. They want to close the really tragic, painful chapter of the last 20 years since 2003. As we all know, Iraq was invaded. And in my opinion, it was of course, illegally invaded. And Iraq has been destroyed. And since then, the region has been going through a lot of mess, a lot of chaos. And of course, around 2011, we had the Arab Spring and the atrocities of the so-called Arab Spring. So the Arabs are already aware of what has happened over the last 20 years, and they have learned really hard lessons. Now, the only way for the Arab world is to really go up, and to go up is to really close that sad chapter, chapter of conflicts, turmoil, and so on and so forth, and really focus on development and on progress, prosperity, and so on and so forth. And this is where China comes into play. If you look at China and look at the Arab world, and if you look at the two the economies of the two sides, you will see so much synergy between the two sides. For example, the Arab world is full of natural resources. We have 40% of the world's proven reserves, oil proven reserves. And China is the largest oil importer, and it's expected to continue importing crude oil for
a long period. Of course, famously, oil has been a curse and an opportunity for this region I'm speaking to you from, precisely as you explained the mass killing that followed the illegal invasion of Iraq by Britain and the United States, etc. I mean, Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman, the Saudi minister, said it's not a zero-sum game. But what if the United States wants to make it a zero-sum game as to who can be a partner of the Arab nations and who can't be in the Middle East? Well, what happens then?
I'm not sure whether they want to dictate, whether they want, first of all, and then whether they can. We are in a totally different world. The relations of the Arab nations are not determined by foreign powers. They are determined by the Arab countries themselves. And the Arabs do not really look for confrontation with any power, whether it be regional or global. The Arabs are really now focusing on developing their economies. First of all, stabilizing the region, and then gradually developing the region and providing prosperity to their people. I agree with the Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman when he says it's not a zero-sum game. And we are not really in a situation where we have to pick sides. We don't have to pick sides. If you look at all the statements made over the last 5 years, you will see that there's a really clear pattern. And that pattern is related to Arabs' desire for strategic autonomy. We are not really in a situation where, you know, we have to really listen to diktats coming from outside of the region or from outside of our countries. And I would assume the decision makers, the politicians in the West, in the United States and Europe would understand. Because if you look at the largest economy in PPP terms, it's already China. The largest trading nation, it's already China. The largest manufacturing nation, it's China. So we Arabs, we want to develop our region. We want to provide, you know, prosperity to our people. If we want to do that, where do we go and get, you know, support, manufactured goods, economic relations, and so on and so forth? China is organically growing, and because of our proximity or being in the center of the globe, we are taking advantage of our situation. We want to really just, you know, exploit the natural resources that we have, and we want to really tap into the developments happening in China and in Asia in general. China is now one of the leading nations in innovation, in AI, 5G, and so on and so forth. So for us, if we want to continue growing economically, why not just, you know, have a stronger relations? And these relations are not really new, and they are not really based only on economics and trade and commerce. If you just go look at the history of our relations, the Arab-China relations, they go really back a long time, 2,000 years, so back to the first Silk Road. And historically, we have really developed deep ties. I live in Guangzhou, China. A lot of people talk about Islam and Islam being banned in China, and so on and so forth. In Guangzhou, there's a mosque called Hasheng. This mosque was built in the 7th century by the uncle of our prophet, Sa'd bin al-As. And this mosque is still existing. And this mosque is really one of the oldest mosques in the world and the oldest mosque in China. When I went there and I exchanged ideas with the other Muslims, the Chinese Muslims, I realized that they were actually having a happy life, a very prosperous life, and a lot of them were owning and running businesses. So just going back to the point of, you know, why just, you know, have this relation with China. It's not only China. China, why China? It's because China is growing rapidly and it's providing us with opportunities.
Yeah, no, so, I mean, you're very clear there. And actually, I wanted to get onto that fake hoax news from Xinjiang that we covered here on Going Underground as NATO Nation Media was spreading that propaganda about so-called genocide in Xinjiang. But, you know, your screen's stopping occasionally. I don't know whether that's the sanctions on Huawei technology. You know there's a battle going on, frankly. I mean, what's the significance of MBS meeting with Blinken? Blinken goes straight there to Saudi Arabia and then calls Putin immediately afterwards. Is this more proof that the zero-sum game is over? But because of these trade ties, if it ever became a zero-sum game, the Global South, the Belt and Road Initiative, the rejuvenation of, the, as you said, the millennia-old relationship is the first choice?
I'm not sure whether there are choices to be made here. I think the region as a whole and the regional leaders and people, they want to be open to all options available. They don't want to restrict their options. So you're talking about the meetings, the recent meetings. And this is also a sign of the positive neutrality of the region, of the Arabs. We don't want to be passively neutral. We don't want to be, you know, sitting by not really contributing to global peace, to global prosperity, and so on and so forth. So it's something you notice when there was this Arab summit, the latest Arab summit. The president of Ukraine was invited to make his case to the Arabs. But then the next day, or a couple of days later, the minister of Interior from Russia arrived, although he was sanctioned by the West, by U.S. and Western countries, but he was welcomed in our region. Why? It's a signal to the world that we are not really taking sides, and we don't have to take sides. If there are really, for example, in the case of Ukraine, the Ukraine conflict, if there's a possibility of the Arabs to contribute to finally, you know, bringing an end to this really tragic conflict, why not? We offer our services and we will try to mediate and help and facilitate. And that's our role. And we don't want to pick sides because we know that if we pick sides, we will be losing. We will be losing whether we choose the West or China or any other party. So for us, we are really interested, determined, to maintain this strategic autonomy. And we have every right to maintain that autonomy. And I think at this point in time, nobody in the world, nothing in the world can actually stop us from being strategically autonomous. In other words, if there are people in the West, in the United States or Europe, who have hegemonic ambitions, they want to really come and dominate the region. Well, if you ask me, over the last 20 years since the Iraq war, this is what's been happening. They have been trying to really dominate the region. They have been trying to really hijack the sovereignty of the region. And they failed. And they failed, you know, miserably. And now, at this point in time, that the region is actually recovering and the getting out of the misery put by really foreigners, the regional leaders, the regional people cannot really give up this strategic autonomy. So just going back to your point, it looks like there's a clash of visions between what the region wants, so what the regional people, regional leaders want for their region, and what some people, not everybody, some people in the United States and in the West want for the region. But at this point in time, we are experiencing dramatic transformations, not only in our region, so regional level, it's the dramatic changes happening at the global level, subglobal levels. At this point in time, I don't think anybody has power to stop the Arabs from really developing and pursuing their development programs, regardless of what others think about these programs.
Ebrahim Hashem, I'll stop you there. More from the Asia Global Fellow at the Asia Global Institute of the University of Hong Kong after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the former strategy advisor to the chairman of the Abu Dhabi Executive Office here in the UAE, Ebrahim Hashem. You're talking about sovereignty for the Arab world, a regained sovereignty for this region. But I don't know whether you remember, well, you know, when you were not in Guangzhou, but were in Abu Dhabi advising the executive office in the UAE here, you know, there are 5,000 maybe US soldiers at a base, at Al Dhafra Air Base near Abu Dhabi. I don't know how many soldiers, U.S. soldiers, are in Saudi Arabia. 3,000 at Prince Sultan Air Base. So you're saying, yeah, there's this great new sovereignty. I mean, you think at any of these meetings people ask, why are the Americans using your countries as air bases, war bases?
Oh, right. So one thing we got to keep in mind, when there's a group of troops in one land, we must really recognize that there is a mutual understanding, a mutual interest between the two sides. So the region for some time has been trying to develop its own security military capacity. And the security agreements or security relations or military relations that, you know, the Arabs have with the United States, I don't think they will end, they will stop. They have been useful, helpful for both sides. So at this point in time, I don't think the Arabs want to just end everything and just, you know, say, okay, we want to be sovereign. We don't want anybody to be involved in our region.
I don't know how they're helpful, because a lot of people would ask that. And do you think there are growing questions about, say, the Patriot missile purchasing by the Saudi Arabian government when the drone attack happened on Aramco's facilities and failed? I mean, I was here 20 years ago at a defense exhibition where Raytheon were marketing these Patriot missiles. Do you think a growing understanding and comprehension in the Arab world that these multi-billion dollar contracts, arguably some might say, keeping these American arms companies in business, it might not be the wisest way to spend money, and it's better to make deals with China and the global south and BRICS countries than just keep supporting the U.S. defense industry infrastructure?
Well, these relations, so the security and military relations are long-term and strategic, and they are not really about one system. They are not about the Patriot defense system. They are really wide-ranging, and they include a lot of items. And the Arabs are not really asking anybody to come and defend them. The Arabs have been getting most of their weaponry from the West, from the United States, and from Europe. And of course, to have to be more strategically autonomous, you will gradually try to diversify the sources of security. So, as you know, that recently there have been growing agreements, contracts between the Arab region, so some Arab countries, with other nations, so with Russia, with China, with Brazil, with India, and so on and so forth. So these are all efforts to really ensure that we have a diverse set of military security suppliers, so that we are not really beholden by anybody. We are not at the mercy of anybody. And this is one major lesson, I think, the Arab people and the Arab leaders have.
I mean, Blinken and Biden are basically, I'm not sure they say officially, they kind of pussyfoot around what they think, but, you know, they kind of condemn normalization between Arab countries and Syria and Iran. What do you think the Arab, I mean, China obviously must just laugh at the fact the United States is condemning what amounts to peace. What do you think Arab countries think when at the State Department people go, what do you think about normalization? And they just go, look, you shouldn't be normalizing ties. Saudi Arabia and the UAE, they shouldn't be normalizing ties with these countries. They should be eternal enemies. I don't know.
I think officially they haven't actually said this. So officially they have been saying, okay, this is good. We hope that it's going to be benefiting the region and so on and so forth. But of course, unofficially, we have heard some statements made that, you know, this is maybe going to be detrimental to their position within the region. But after all, These decisions are sovereign decisions made based on the interests of the Arabs of the region. Iran is part of the region. So the both sides of the Gulf historically, for a long period of time, have had a lot of cultural diffusion, infusion, a lot of cultural civilizational exchanges. And we have really strong trade ties and so on and so forth. And now that we are really realizing that maybe at this point in time to really ensure stability for our region and to grow together, maybe we have to really explore options that we, both sides, we just, you know, find a common ground.
Well, trade, but I have to say trade is difficult in this region because of CSIS sanctions, of Western European and American sanctions. Because you keep talking about sovereignty, but you know that the United States will start saying, will start sanctioning countries in this region if they do business as they please down to their sovereign will.
I'm not sure how many Arab countries really following the CSIS sanctions. I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether anybody within the region following the CSIS sanctions. I know.
You might have to just explain what they are to our audience because they're not given much publicity, unprecedented level of attempts to hurt populations in the Arab world and the Middle East.
I think the sanctions are not really UN enacted sanctions. They are unilaterally put by United States and
Brussels, nations, Washington, China. And Brussels, and London.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So. So for us, we don't have to follow these sanctions. Why should we follow sanctions put in place unilaterally by United States or Europe? And they are, in our opinion, they are really just harming the people of Syria, not really harming the government. The government can actually just work out ways to survive, and it has survived more than 10 years. And it's the people that have been really suffering, and the regional people, the regional countries, and the regional leaders want to really help alleviate this suffering that is happening in Syria. I personally think this is a major tragedy. What happened to Syria is a major tragedy. And the Arabs and different parts of the Arab world want to do whatever they can to really accelerate the process of renormalizing the situation in Syria and bringing Syria back to the global stage and removing all these sanctions.
Actually, can I just say, though, what's happened to
the reconstruction work?
What's happened to all the Islamist violence that used to be leading the news before the invasion, before the war between Russia and the U.S. and through Ukraine? What's happened to it all? Why has it suddenly stopped? Have you been suspicious of it? Are people a bit suspicious that all these Islamist groups seem to have just disappeared since the United States focused on one spot, Kiev?
I think it's no secret who uses these people, terrorism in general, in our region to advance their interests. And these people, so the Islamists and the others, the Al-Qaeda and the Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups and others, they have been used as tools to really destabilize certain parts of our region in an attempt to really hijack their sovereignty. And these Islamists, the regional countries have been demanding that whatever country has nationals in Syria, come and take them back to your countries and just, deal with them. And they don't want to do that. And if you just see where these Islamist fighters, I don't want to use the word Islam in their name, these really barbaric terrorists, a lot of them, a major portion of them actually came from the West. And in the region, the last more than 10 years, the regional agencies, intelligence agencies, and other government organizations have gathered, mountains and mountains of evidence of intelligence, who these people are, where they were trained, and who supported them financially, who transported them, and so on and so forth. So If you know the world thinks that the region and the regional countries do not know who these people are and who is behind them, I think they are mistaken. The regional countries already know what's going on. And
officially, of course, the U.S. denies it, and the British intelligence services deny it. We won't have time to go into the Xinjiang lies. People can watch our program about the so-called Uyghur genocide. How do you think the Biden administration might be able to sabotage August's BRICS summit? And what hopes and fears do you have for it, the BRICS summit in August in South Africa?
I'm not sure the BRICS countries and the invited countries will have to listen to, you know, non-parties to the summit. I think the BRICS will have to just, you know, focus on their agenda, and they have a lot of items on their agenda, one of which is basically thinking about how to introduce a new currency and also how to expand BRICS. As we know that there's a lot of discussion about BRICS Plus, and UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, and Iran were invited, and the Arab, I mean, the Saudi and Emirati foreign ministers were there physically, and the Iranian foreign minister was there physically, and the Egyptian foreign minister connected through I think Zoom or something, virtually. Anyway, so BRICS is the nucleus that is actually trying to drive this global multipolarity, and there are so many countries interested in joining. As you know, we have Saudi Arabia, we have UAE and Egypt, and a couple of other Arab countries are interested in actually by joining. So more than 19, according to some sources, around 30 countries are interested. And if the oil exporting countries like UAE, Saudi Arabia, and others join, it's going to be a really huge, huge group. It will bring the energy producers.
I was actually asking about the sabotage. Ebrahim Hashem, we'll have to talk about the sabotage after the meeting and see what the United States and NATO nations did to the BRICS countries. Ebrahim Hashem, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And that's it for the show. We'll be back on Saturday with a brand new episode. Until then, you can keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.